KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Lower Haight.
Tenderloin. Half Moon Bay.
Sutter Heights.
I live in the Union Square.
Coming up, Bay Area counties are expecting millions of dollars from a lawsuit about lead paint, but getting that money may not be as easy as it looks.
Here's the catch. The counties have to spend this money in 4 years.
Then we'll meet Hayward's newest council member, an Afghan-American millennial woman who's already making waves in the city council.
Once you're elected, every single person will tell you you're no longer allowed to be an organizer or an activist.
And we go through the looking glass with a theater artist who's adding her modern take to classic fairy tales.
I think people are looking to these old stories to try to rekindle hope and imagination.
Happily ever after? Find out on Cross Currents. Five Bay Area counties have won millions of dollars in a lead paint lawsuit, but now they say the paint companies are doing everything they can to prevent them from getting it. KALW reporters Angela Johnston and Marissa Ortega-Welch have been covering the issue of childhood lead poisoning in the Bay Area for almost 2 years, and they're here today to give us an update about an 18-year-old lawsuit that's about to come to an end. Hey, Marissa and Angela.
Hi.
So you told us in your reporting that lead-based paint is the number one cause of childhood lead poisoning in the Bay Area. The Bay Area is full of homes built before 1978 when lead paint was banned. So tell us about this lawsuit against the paint manufacturers.
Okay, so way back in 2000, the year 2000, Santa Clara County sued big paint manufacturers for knowingly marketing lead paint.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to it being banned. A bunch of other counties from around California joined in the lawsuit, including five counties here in the Bay Area. That's Alameda, San Francisco, Santa Clara, San Mateo, and Solano.
This lawsuit has been in the courts this whole time, for basically 18 years. The paint manufacturers appealed a lower court ruling. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court, but finally a decision has been reached and the lawsuit is over. The judge ruled in favor of the counties, saying that the paint companies were in fact responsible for causing this public nuisance of lead hazards.
Okay, and what does that mean now?
So now these paint companies, like Sherwin-Williams, have to pay the cities and counties that sued them for causing these childhood lead poisoning problems. Mm-hmm. These are present-day companies that are now, in 2019, having to pay for what they did decades ago, from the 20s to the 50s.
And how much money are we talking about?
Well, it's about $400 million for all of the people involved in the lawsuit.
Uh-huh.
How much money each county gets depends on the percentage of old homes, homes that were built before the companies stopped marketing lead paint.
The money that the paint companies owe is going into what's called an abatement fund. And counties are going to have to apply for money from this fund to do lead abatement work.
Okay.
This could be things like public outreach about lead poisoning or actually going into homes and fixing peeling paint on windowsills and doors, stuff like that.
So this isn't about victims or money going to victims of being sick from this. This is going to counties. Why?
That's a really good question, right? To abate, to deal with this problem of lead paint that still persists in old homes.
Today,
okay. Yeah. So about going in and fixing some of these potential health hazards in the homes. No, it's not going to individuals that are suffering from lead poisoning, but...
But individuals can apply for money through a county.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that your kid is suffering from lead poisoning because you lived in a home that was built in 1906 and was painted with lead paint.
Uh-huh.
You could apply, say, I want my house painted over. You could apply for money from this fund, potentially.
Okay.
That would, you know, kid still has lead poisoning in the end,
right.
But you're containing the source.
Here's the catch. The court said that the counties have to spend this money in 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't, they have to give the money back to the paint companies.
4 years is not a lot of time.
No, it's not a lot of time. And the interesting thing is every time a county submits one of these grant applications to get money from the fund, the paint manufacturers will have a chance to contest the application.
Which means it could take more time for the counties to get the money, and then it will take them longer to spend it. So basically, the counties are worried that the paint manufacturers will just keep contesting these grant applications
mm-hmm.
as a way to run out the clock on those 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because remember, paint companies get the money back if it's not spent in 4 years.
Okay, that's a waste of time. Counties are not going to like that.
Yeah, and so the counties are asking the judge to come up with a solution for this. Basically, they want the 4-year time period to work like a game clock in basketball. Every time the paint companies appeal one of these grant applications or work out the details, the counties want the 4-year time period to be paused. Mm-hmm.
Just like the clock gets stopped in a game when there's a foul and the referees are debating something.
Okay, so the county gets the money, property owners can apply through their county, and then what?
Then the property owners, like we said, can use that money to fix certain lead hazards in their home.
But the paint companies say when people are exposed to lead paint hazards, it's because the property owners let the property deteriorate to hazardous conditions. Mm-hmm. And the paint companies don't think they should be responsible for that or have to pay for that. They put the onus on property owners and the cities and counties, which the paint companies say should just be enforcing current California habitability laws. Mm-hmm. And so here's the thing that really stood out to Marissa and I when we were looking through these court documents. The paint manufacturers have actually said in court that they may consider suing property owners who apply for these funds.
Okay, so you're saying paint companies are talking about suing property owners for using money from an abatement fund that the court ordered them to pay into. Can they even do that?
It's still being discussed. We spoke to Javier Serrano. He's a lawyer for Santa Clara County that's working on this case, and he says the details are still being figured out, but his county believes that the paint companies don't have that right.
Mm-hmm. He says the paint companies are doing this as a way to intimidate property owners from applying for money, and again, a way to run out that clock on the 4 years so that the paint companies get the money back. But they say they have a right to oversee how their money is being spent. Mm.
And they say they're already doing their part. You know, companies that produce lead-based products already pay a fee that goes toward lead poisoning prevention programs. Mm-hmm.
And like you said, the paint companies think governments should be responsible for making sure the homes in their cities are up to code and not exposing people to hazards like lead or like mold.
Yes, Oakland, for example, has been talking about creating a program where the city would go in and proactively inspect rental properties for health hazards like lead. This is a program that's been proven to reduce childhood lead poisoning in other parts of the country. And the city of Oakland's program could potentially use money coming in from the lawsuit to fund its work.
And this is a program that Angela and I have been covering for the last 2 years. The city of Oakland has been talking about it for over a decade. Mm-hmm. You know, we told you back in December, Hana, that the city council was supposed to get a plan together. And here it is, March, and there's still no plan. Mm. So we'll be continuing to follow that and tell you about it.
And we'll keep asking you about it. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Angela Johnston is our environment reporter. Marissa Ortega-Welch is our science reporter. And you can hear their award-winning series, Persistent Poison, at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. The city of Hayward's got a new council member. She's a millennial, a renter, and an Afghan American. Aisha Wahab is a 31-year-old IT consultant. Her late parents fled war in Afghanistan, and then she was fostered by an Afghan American couple from the time she was 10. And last November, Wahab was one of two to share the title for first Afghan American woman elected to office in the U.S. During her campaign, she faced racism, Islamophobia, and people expressing doubt because of her age. She's been compared to other young progressive women of color, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. Wahab ran on a platform that centered housing, living wage, and jobs in a city where the median age is 34 and the median household income is $65,000. I chatted with her in her office at Hayward City Hall.
I want far more housing at all income levels. I've said that consistently. I believe housing is a human right. That's my number one thing. I want a more transparent government, a more accurate and reliable decision-making process. And I want us to be considered a leader in the East Bay. Right now, Hayward is that city that everybody drives through, that nobody really pays attention to. Within the county, Berkeley, Oakland, and Fremont are the most talked about cities. And Hayward compared to, you know, our size is actually pretty big. We are ignored on every issue. I think Hayward is a place of untapped potential, to be completely honest with you. I think that for me, I want Hayward to be a leader for working people. And the reason why I'm pushing the agendas that I'm pushing, these items of equal pay, accelerated minimum wage, housing at all income levels, these are the core issues that a family cares about. If you have a roof over your head, you will go to school, you will be stable in your family structure, you will have a lot more opportunity in your future. I'm tackling all those problems, and I'm not making a lot of friends along the way, I'm going to say that. My biggest one was actually mental health and de-escalation training for fire and police or safety personnel. So these are actually really, really tough issues that I'm pushing within my first couple months. I'll tell you that people keep telling me to wait for the priority setting retreat that the council is going to have in May. If I were to do that, it means I would have waited 6 months before I even tossed an idea. And I just don't believe that if we aren't acting fast enough, it means that you don't understand that people are actually hurting.
So is this new, you think, to the council, kind of this pace? And where does that come from? Is it because, you know, do you feel like I'm new here? I want to hit the ground running?
I genuinely believe that being a millennial does make you want to move things a little bit faster. I had a meeting just this past week where they were like, you're making too many waves at the very beginning, right? So if you are asking for this, what are you going to ask for in year three, right? Out of your 4 years that you're going to sit here. And I said, whatever's needed then.
The nation, you know, is celebrating these young women, young, diverse women who've been voted into office recently. And I think for the Bay Area, people in the Bay Area have been celebrating you in that regard, kind of the young child of immigration, person of color, coming in to shake things up, bold. You mentioned it's hard to get people on the city council to like hear you, all of this stuff. What change do you really think you can make in terms of these generational gaps, or how do you get people to hear you?
You know, I've had the pleasure of actually meeting some of these change makers that we see on or in Congress. So from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to Rashida Tlaib to Ilhan Omar, I've met all three of these women. They are phenomenal when you meet them. They're down to earth. They get it. They, you know, are very lovely human beings, if you will. And, you know, their politics, even amongst the three, are very different from each other. And I think that more attention has been paid on these handful of women of color, a little bit younger, with a different background. So I think elected officials have historically been a little more privileged, usually lawyers, and usually of a similar demographic across the board. Now, for me, I don't actually see the generational issue as a problem, although I actually had a conversation about this with a woman who's a little bit older than me yesterday, and we chatted about this. And she says that her generation has been eclipsed by the baby boomers and skipped onto the millennials. And I see it. 100%, I would have to agree with her. And I don't think that that's necessarily a problem, but she said that for her, it's the fact that her generation will never hold power or sway the direction of this country or this state or this local community the way that the baby boomers have. And we are, and she stated this, that her generation as well as my generation are affected by the baby boomers. This is true. 100%. And millennials will be the largest voting bloc within a couple years, right? Now, I think that this is good, primarily because millennials overall, we have, to be completely honest with you, we are the most well-informed generation due to the fact that we have information at our fingertips and we grew up like that. At the same time, the issues, and I always come back to the issues, it is the issues that matter. Once you're elected, every single person will tell you you're no longer allowed to be an organizer or an activist. Everyone will tell you that. Every elected has told me that.
Now you're a politician.
Yes.
What does that mean, though?
I hate the word politician because it basically means you're fake and you're going to, like, say yes to everybody.
And you're not going to do much.
Yeah, pretty much, right? And they say, well, if you want to move up in the ranks, you know, you got to do X, Y, and Z. That's really not where I'm at. Otherwise, I wouldn't have brought up half of the topics that I've brought up in the first couple weeks of me being in office. I am making sure that we move in the right direction, that we serve our community. And that's what people elected me for, and that's what I plan on doing.
That's newly elected Hayward Councilwoman Aisha Wahab. You can find out more about what she's doing in Hayward. We'll have a link at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Growing up in Berkeley, theater artist Anne Yumi Kabori caught the acting bug at a young age. As a child, she'd put on performances of classic tales like Cinderella and even design her own costumes. After college, Anne started the Utopia Theater Project as a way to produce theater that inspires social change. She takes old stories and makes them accessible to modern audiences. The company's latest production is called Everyday Alice, and it reimagines characters from Alice in Wonderland and Peter Pan in a modern-day setting while exploring the line between mental health and artistic expression. Anne sat down with KELW's Janae Darden to talk about the new show.
I obviously like to have many roles in the theater. So when I was a kid, we did a production of Cinderella at my house. I costumed it, and I believe I played, not Cinderella, but I played the evil stepmother, and I directed the production.
And
we
did. How old were you?
I was probably about 7 or 8.
You were serious.
Yeah.
So this was something you were passionate about from the beginning.
Yes, I've always loved stories. I loved reading growing up. Read so many different children's books and young adult stories and fairy tales and novels that I think that sort of fueled my imagination. Mm-hmm. And did also align with plays and being in theater and doing dance shows and learning how to sing. I think I always had the performance bug for sure. I think people are looking to these old stories to try to rekindle hope and imagination and that old idea of magic.
And also to challenge, because you said, you know, you have some social justice themes in your work.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you go to the root of a lot of these stories, these fairy tales, they're centered around a moral compass and facing down evil or darkness and finding your inner strength and bringing together comrades and other people who are like-minded or at least like gold and to pursue justice.
In addition to acting, you also started Utopia Theater Project. So tell me about it and what made you start this theater company?
I started the company in 2014. When I was in college at Santa Clara University, I'd previously been in New York at Sarah Lawrence to study theater there. It was fun to be in New York, but it's nice to be back in California among all the California people. And I really have always had a desire to pursue social justice work, but through the medium of theater. There are a lot of other companies who are doing that, which is wonderful. But I really was hoping to do something that focused on not just new works, but a reimagined classics. So taking old stories and transforming them and making them really accessible to modern audiences while keeping that magic of imagination and story alive.
You know, I'm noticing there is a reimagining of story. So the show is not on anymore, but Once Upon a Time. There's this kind of retelling of these stories with some serious messages in them. Why do you think now that we're starting to see that?
I think it's probably because we are in, I would say, somewhat of a dark time. A lot of what we see on television and in the news is violence and
hate and discrimination and not a lot of hope, I think, overall. There's still hope and there's still many good things being done and many good people pursuing like worthy goals and making changes. But I think this overall feeling is of darkness and gloom. And I think there are a lot of people that identify with Alice and that she's very curious and she gets caught up in this world that she doesn't understand, but she has all these adventures and then remembers them when she wakes up.
So what is this play about?
I think distilling it down, it's really about young people today, especially artists, so this millennial generation, which I like to call the lost generation or the second lost generation, like Gertrude Stein's post-World War I lost generation, and how we're trying to find love and purpose and meaning and careers in a world that is not super conducive to any of those things. It's very hard to pay the rent, and it's really hard to be an artist in this time and pursue what you feel is your passion and your maybe your mission in life. It's healing not just to create art, you know, by yourself in a room, but also to come together with a community of artists and share stories.
So we're looking at, you know, this borderline between mental health and artistic expression, but also too, and I'm hearing what you're saying, art can also be healing.
So I am a survivor of sexual assault and domestic violence, and that's something that is now in my past, very much so. But it is something that I live with every day and that reality. And one of the ways I deal with that is by being in shows, being in plays and creating and writing. And I thought, well, I think there are probably other people who do a similar thing. So let me make that essence of the character part of Alice, layering onto the original fairy tale. Mm-hmm. It's a little darker, it's a little more adult, but I think there are a lot of people who identify with someone who has trauma who's trying to move through that through art and creation.
And fairy tales are dark anyway, when you read the real versions, and not so much the Disney versions, right?
They are.
What's the challenge of bringing these characters to life in this age and retelling their stories? Because, you know, we hold on to these images of these characters that we've grown up with, generations and generations before us have grown up with. And so you're painting them in a different light. What's the challenge and the pressure?
There is perhaps some external pressure of, oh, I hope people recognize these characters, but I threw in quite a few nuggets of quotes from the source material, not the Disney versions or anything like that, but the actual play Peter Pan and Wendy by Jane Barry, and also the two stories by Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland and Alice Through the Looking Glass. So if you've read them or want to read them now, there are quite a few things that you would notice that are similar. And also, I just think that, you know, it's at a certain point, I just didn't really care because this is just my interpretation and people will maybe see things that remind them of their childhood and maybe not. But either way, they're just such fun, vivid characters. And I think it comes through in some way.
This play almost didn't exist. What stopped you from writing it or finishing it?
I could not figure out how to get Alice and Peter Pan to be compatible in a relationship. Maybe because it's hard to be compatible with someone who can't grow up if you want to be in an adult relationship with them. But also maybe it's hard to be with someone who is struggling with their identity as an artist and really needs to just put that first. And I think one of the big cruxes of it is, how do you escape? How do you run away? Everyone has their own form of escapism, and Alice's is maybe her imagination.
That was theater artist Anne Yumi Kabori talking with KELW's Janae Darden. You can catch Anne this weekend in the Utopia Theater Project's performance of Everyday Alice. That's at Piano Fight in San Francisco. And if you'd like to keep up with shows from around the Bay, you can subscribe to the Cross Currents newsletter. Make sure to do that. Go to kalw.org and get yours once a week, every week, right in your inbox. This music is by GMS from Santa Cruz. They'll perform at the Center for New Music in San Francisco Friday night. Today's Cross Currents team includes Joanne DeLuna, Lisa Morehouse, True Quinn, Eli Wertschafter, and Aaliyah Yates. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.